Thank you for downloading the Sparkwood and 21 podcast. We are discussing the television series Twin Peaks. This podcast is brought to you by No Ship Network. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve. Spoiler warning, we are not a spoiler-free podcast. We spoil. So if you have not seen the entire series, please do so before listening to us. We would love to have you on, but we don't want to ruin anything for you.
If you like this podcast, the best way to support us is to head over to iTunes and write us a review. It helps attract traffic to us.
Here's what you can do. If you don't want to write a review, just go over there, write your favorite kind of donut in the description. That's all you have to do. Then we'll know that you're one of the Twin Peaks listeners that we reached with this podcast. Click on how many stars you think are appropriate. I like to think we're a 5-star podcast, but I don't want to coerce anybody. But if you're just going over there just to do it, definitely click on 5 stars. If you click on anything less than 5, you can give a description. But let us know how we can improve, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, give us a reason why you're doing that.
We also have an Amazon link, which is a great way to support the podcast, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. Just go over to noship.net, click on the Amazon link, and from there it takes you to the Amazon homepage, and you do your shopping like normal. And like I said, it doesn't cost you anything extra, but we get a little bit of a kickback for said donuts and coffee and giant chess pieces that we can put metalheads in.
PSA.
For the remainder of the podcast, for your safety and ours, please stay on the bike.
All right, any thoughts on this episode before we get into recap?
Thoughts on this week's episode. I actually liked last week's episode better. I didn't think this episode was bad, but it's kind of like when you're going to see a band you really like, you know they're coming on stage, and you're watching the opening bands, and you're just kind of nodding your head like, okay. There wasn't anything horrible in this scene, or in this episode, rather, but I did the recap for last week's episode, and I just found it a lot more engaging, and I'm just kind of glad I didn't do the recap for this one.
It wasn't too bad. It did drag a little, but it wasn't too bad. I will say that I do not think we're going to be able to dig too deep into this episode.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of insight to unravel. Not a lot of subtext to really chew on. That's okay, though. It's a setup episode for further things to come.
So just, listener, if you're new, just stay tuned. Feedback is always interesting, so it will get better.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, right when we tuned in and did the introductions to this episode and everything, be like, okay, on to feedback. Feedback's always our favorite part anyway, but especially when there's episodes when there's not really all that much that's just like bam pow awesome. And Twin Peaks has had a lot of bam pow awesome moments, just not in this episode.
So do you want to talk about how we both think this title of this episode's really dumb?
Yeah, it's a horrible title. I don't know where the hell they came up with that one. Variations on Relations. I really don't even know what that's referring to. Usually I can kind of glean a little bit here and there, something that leads me to kind of get an insight into why the whoever did titled it that way, but nothing. I'm coming up with nothing on this one.
Okay, so this episode is Twin Peaks Season 2, Variations on Relations, directed by Jonathan Singer, written by Mark Frost and Harley Payton. The sheriff's department is now re-entering Owl Cave. Someone has done their work for them. There are tracks in the dirt, and Hawk claims they are the same tracks that he found outside the power station. Cooper knows immediately that they are Wyndham Earl's. Do you think it is his sixth sense, or has he Earl's tracks memorized?
I'm not really sure, but when Hawk is talking about he leans to his, he shifts his weight to his left, and there's a broken heel, and that could be some sort of idiosyncrasy that Cooper's familiar with.
Cooper tasks Andy with a large-scale rendering of the pictograph. Harry leaves to go contact Major Briggs. Cooper contemplates the pictograph. End of scene.
Yeah, it's a quickie. It was kind of just letting us get in there to know that, okay, now this is what Wyndham Earl uncovered. This is what the pictograph looks like. Here's what you're getting.
Wyndham Earl tells Leo about the White Lodge. He despises the White Lodge with all of its virtues and do-gooders. He then tells Leo about the Black Lodge. The heavy metal dude, Rusty Tomasky, is there waiting for his promised beer and party. And it's Ted fucking Raimi.
Oh, yeah. We're big Ted Raimi fans.
Jocks are the mighty.
If you're a Xena fan, you know who Ted Raimi is. If you're a Evil Dead fan, you know who Ted Raimi is. We like him in both and some other stuff that he's done. He's great. And we kept hearing feedback about, oh, yeah, the episode coming up is going to have the heavy metal dude in it. You know, he gets trapped in the chess piece. And I kept thinking to myself, at the time, I didn't know. I had seen the Evil Dead movies before, way before we watched Twin Peaks, but it didn't strike me as Ted Raimi because I think I was watching it on this crappy VHS copy.
Well, Ted Raimi's in costume in Evil Dead. Like, you can't even hardly tell it's Ted Raimi.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I probably wouldn't have recognized him from sight anyway, even if it was crystal clear.
So you want to talk about how the 90s, like I think about a lot of the media that came out during that time, and they always make metalheads look like idiots.
It's true. This isn't something I expected to talk about, but it's something that I will always talk about.
Oh.
So I was a metalhead during the late 80s and early 90s, but I mean, I still am. Once you're a metalhead, you're always a metalhead. That's just how it works. But back then I actually had the long hair and the jean jacket, and you just living like that and not, I wasn't a smoker or a drinker or anything like that, but I pretty much had all the other trappings of a heavy metal lifestyle. And man, you would think that the media thought that a metalhead never picked up a book in his life. I remember the movie Airheads with Brendan Fraser and Adam Sandler and
Steve
Steve
Buscemi.
Buscemi. Yeah, I mean, that was just horribly bad representation of metalheads. And we're not even going to get into Beavis and Butthead. It's just we just get a really bad rap. I think when it comes to subcultures that are based upon music, and you have media representations of said subcultures, metalheads get it worse than anybody else. You never see people who listen to, say, just exclusively pop music or rap music or salsa music, I don't know, just to pick something off the top of my head, get that kind of singled out representation to where you're just, wow, this person is just really a piece of shit.
You metalheads are just special.
I guess so. But I mean, I've known enough bonehead metalheads in my time to actually see where people get the idea that we're like that, and it's unfortunate. But there's plenty of exceptions. It's not like the, when they say, well, there's the one person there, the exception that proves the rule. It's not like that. There was a lot of really smart metalheads, and when you get into the music itself, a lot of it, the intricacies that are required to play it are just, I mean, you can't be a stupid person and do it, is all I'm really getting at.
Well, I thought I'd slide a soapbox over to you and
Thank you. I
you're
hope I
welcome.
fulfilled everybody's idea of what I would sound like on a soapbox.
Okay, so yes, the heavy metal dude is there waiting for his promised beer and party. Okay, so the camera pans away from the men and over to a screen depicting the pictograph from Owl Cave. So either Windham Earle has a hidden camera or he rendered it on an Etch-a-Sketch.
I was thinking Etch-a-Sketch too. You got to the joke first, but when I'm looking at this thing, I mean, this is an early 90s version of a computer, and I'm still kind of scratching my head as to how he was able to get the picture of the pictograph onto the computer. I don't know if they had scanning technology then, or, I mean, they had to have some rudimentary form of it, but.
I'm really hoping it's an Etch-a-Sketch.
Well, I didn't see the little twisty knobs, and usually Etch-a-Sketches are
They
red.
do. You're right. Anything, I mean, we haven't really gotten that great of an image of the pictograph at this point, but did you have any comments on it?
It just looks like a cave drawing of you see like there's a an older what looks to be like a human being and a younger one standing next to each other,
Like
almost holding hands, I think.
the Tremonts?
Oh yeah, like the Tremonts. That's a really good point. I guess I should have given a little bit more thought to what was in the pictograph, but there was a number. There's a looks like a 24, or no, it's a 4, but the edge of the 4,
That's the astrological symbol.
that's an astrological symbol. Okay, so it's not a number at all. And then there's of course the ring. You can see that.
I'm pretty sure right under the astrological symbol there's a waterfall.
The Great Northern Waterfall.
Yeah, there's also this circle of sycamore trees.
It's an entry point, and that comes into play a couple episodes later. So
Yes.
Bob's able to get into our world, and they're able to get into the lodge through that.
Right. So now at the Packard household, Pete ruminates over a poem about Josie while messing around with the chessboard. Catherine enters and wants him to open the box that Jones left for her from Eckhart. He figures out that it is a puzzle box, and opening the puzzle box could take years.
She's not too pleased about this, and I wasn't really too pleased about the scene. As much as I like Pete, whenever he goes on and on about Josie, I understand their relationship, I get it, but I don't know. I was just never sold on her from the beginning, as you guys who have listened to this podcast consistently know. Not a Josie fan. And just to hear him going on about how beautiful she is and this and that, and it's just kind of like, all right, somebody come in. Catherine was a perfect foil to that. Like, shut your mouth, help me with this.
Well, I think they kind of sets the stage for Harry to come in and ask about Josie later, so it's not like a cold open of somebody asking about or talking about Josie, if that makes sense.
Yeah, he was kind of used as a preamble to get
Right.
Josie in everybody's mind because she's been dead for a few episodes now, and we're hoping we can move past it. But of course, Harry's still in the grieving stages. He's not drunk anymore, though. That's progress.
Didn't Pete seem like a little bit more dopey than usual in this scene with the box?
Yeah, he had a slower pace to his speech. He's like, it's a puzzle box. You know, it was like intentionally drug out.
Okay, so moving on to the next scene. Bobby talks to Shelley at the diner. He has the secret to success. Beautiful people get everything they want, and he is suggesting that she enters the pageant. She's not interested, and he gets upset and says, Bobby is in charge, you understand? She gives him a dirty look and walks away, taking the beauty pageant flyer with her.
Bobby's acting a lot like Leo in this scene. I don't see how she just doesn't go, okay, we're done. Get the fuck out of here. I mean, that's exactly, you know, he was supposed to be the knight in shining armor, you know, Prince Charming. He was supposed to take her away from all that. You know, Leo's the bad, controlling one. Bobby's the person who's the same age and understanding, and they actually have a real connection and stuff like that. Now, Bobby's just acting like a jackass and trying to see what he can get out of her. So he's treating her the exact same way. You're just a tool to help my success. Whereas she was just a tool to clean his house and do his laundry, you know.
Yeah.
So in either situation, she's just an attachment to this man.
I'm thinking maybe she's seen a side of him that she never saw a side of Leo, and so that's why she's given him the benefit of the doubt, or at least hasn't fully, put the kibosh on the relationship at this point. She definitely seems like she's at the end of a rope with him, but we know that I think they work things out in the end, if I remember correctly.
But the only reason he's even there is because he got the cold shoulder from Audrey. You know,
Yeah,
if
but
she had
she
warmed it,
doesn't know that.
she doesn't know that, but it doesn't make you like Bobby anymore.
No. So Lana and Mayor Milford are also at the diner, and she tells him she wants to win the pageant. He is one of the judges, so he could guarantee it. Okay, and my question is about Lana, who's probably my least favorite character in this entire series. If you have that kind of power over men, which has been demonstrated, I mean, she even has it over Cooper, Harry, everybody.
Yeah, all the men.
Your only ambition is to win the Twin Peaks beauty pageant? Really? That's what you're going to do with it?
You could rule the world, but you just want to get that Miss Twin Peaks.
Mean, why haven't you even left Twin Peaks?
It could be possible that her power only exists in Twin Peaks.
Maybe.
They're just throwing it out there. I mean, there's not a lot of real answers that we're ever going to get to that question. I'm pretty sure she's not one of the characters that's coming back next year, so.
So Cooper walks into the diner and invites Annie out for a nature study later that afternoon. She accepts and then walks away to get the donuts he has ordered. Shelley walks up to the register and begins to read from the poem Wyndham Earle had left for her at the diner previously. Cooper tells her he needs to see the poem immediately. She tells him how she, Donna, and Audrey received the notes. He tells Annie he will meet her back at the diner at 4 o'clock sharp. Of course, I truncated that quite a bit, but there you go.
He's putting the pieces together.
Soon will be,
Soon will
yes.
be, yeah. But he has an idea. He has an inkling. This is yet another symptom of their really stiff and weird, yet oddly becoming relationship between the two of them because they're both weird. They're both really weird. So it makes sense that they would do something like that. But I think it also makes sense that somebody like her, who's obviously attempted suicide and has spent time in a freaking convent, you need to go a little bit slow. Your first date doesn't need to be dinner and a movie and then back to, you know, my room at the Great Northern for a romp fest. It needs to be something very slow at a deliberate pace where intentions are clear and you can get to know each other as people, you know, which I think that's good advice for any two people going out on a date,
Yeah.
honestly. But in this case especially, it fits. But a nature thing, I mean, I never would have thought to do that. Maybe that's just me. I don't know.
Because you're a metalhead.
I guess so, yeah. So let's go see Slayer down at the Palladium tonight. It'll be awesome.
Don't want to seem like I'm being derisive about asking her to go on a nature study, because I actually think it's a cool idea, especially since it's Cooper asking, because he's not putting on airs.
Right.
And I think because she had was able to identify a chickadee, he thought, oh, maybe she'll be into this.
Yeah, it's kind of sweet. He's trying to play off what he at least perceives to be her interests.
Right.
Like she has at least a modicum of interest in the great outdoors. She knows what the hell a chickadee was when, you know, the bird watcher thought it was something else. So,
Okay.
you know, when he's when he's not doing his police work and goofing off, he's not even doing it well.
Speaking of Harry. Back at the sheriff's department, Harry attempts to read the poem out loud and asks, what is it all about?
It's just coming out really like slowly and just blocky.
Yeah, when he's reading the poem, see, my question asking if he was well read was valid. I think this set points to no.
Well, he's a bookhouse boy, but he does, he, you know, and he was in love and everything, but he definitely doesn't have the cadence of poetry in his speech, that's for sure.
I guess we have to cut him some slack because it is a poem that's been ripped into thirds, and he's reading one of the thirds.
Yeah, I guess so, because you're right. He's just reading the words as he sees them. It's not in a whole poem thing, but
It's still hilarious to listen to him read it, though.
it is, because he sounds like a fifth grader who's about to be held back for the third time, trying to read his homework assignment out loud. God damn it, Harry, you're a bookhouse boy. I expected more.
Cooper explains that it is a poem he once sent to Caroline. Harry says they should talk to the girls as soon as they can. Hawk, already at it, brings in the poem from Donna. Hawk reports that Audrey's in Seattle. Cooper asks Harry for Leo's arrest report. He's putting the pieces together.
Yeah, he's pretty astute at looking at people's handwriting and being able to tell, because he even makes accommodation for the fact that it would be a little bit different after what happened to him, but he can still tell that it was his handwriting.
So now Andy is rendering the pictograph and Major Briggs is correcting his mistake. And in fact, Major Briggs looks almost murderous to me about this mistake that Andy's done with the pictograph.
Maybe he's got like a little bit of Albert in him, and he just has a low tolerance for people being stupid right in front of him.
Maybe. So Cooper comes in and he gets Major Briggs up to date with everything involving Wyndham Earl, Leo Johnson, and the pictograph. He tells Major Briggs he needs to know everything about Wyndham Earl's involvement with the Project Blue Book. So Major Briggs, even though he no longer has security clearance, doesn't mean he does not have access. However, he may have some moral issues involved here. And he asks Cooper if giving that information to him will help save some lives, and Cooper says most assuredly. So we get a quick scene of him recalling his dream or vision of the pictographs, and then Major Briggs agrees to do as Cooper has asked. So this is also the first time in this episode we see the man in the hood, which I think is the same man that Major Briggs saw and that also
When
Andy
he
Dale Cooper
disappeared for a
saw,
few days.
right?
Yeah, I was assuming that that was the same character. Or not character, but I say character as in like that shady character over there in the corner. But I was assuming that was the same entity.
I think in feedback we have some questions. They're asking us like who we think it is.
We can just address it then, I guess.
Yeah, so we'll move on. Okay. Hawk brings in Leo's arrest report. Cooper compares the handwriting and determines that the poem was written by Leo Johnson.
Who is in cahoots somehow, in some way, with Wyndham Earl?
Correct. It's not a lot to say about these scenes.
No, there's not. They're pretty straightforward. They don't offer a lot of subtext or anything like that. It's just kind of like, this is what's happening. This is, you know, I kind of expected a little bit more out of Mark Frost coming back to the writing fold for an episode.
Yeah.
I thought it would just be a little bit jazzed up and spicier, but it's not really. That's why I said that at the beginning of the pod that I actually liked the last episode better, and I'm glad that's the one that I did the recap for.
Just keep rubbing it in. Okay, so now we're at the Great Northern. Dick talks to Ben Horn about the approaching wine tasting and not being able to find Audrey. Ben tells him that Audrey is away on business and the concierge will be able to assist him with whatever he needs. Ben then asks about his nose. He says that he will pay any medical expenses Dick has, and Dick asks for workers' comp while he's still ahead. Ben is agreeable. Dick says he will contact his lawyer, and Ben resists the urge to do bad.
It makes you wonder though what kind of workers' comp you would need, because a nose injury like that wouldn't prevent you from doing your job. If all you are is a retail salesman and you can still do wine tastings when you're dipping your freaking nose into some wine, I'm pretty sure you can stand there and watch people try on designer suits. So a scene was a little bit off for me. I think it was really there just to show you that Ben Horn's still here. He's still trying to do good, but now it's getting tested, and he's almost failing these tests. But out comes the carrot, and everything's okay.
I just want to say about Ian Buchanan, the way he's playing this scene with it's like he's a sycophantic villain. He would play a really good one. He probably has somewhere, but he's playing it with some relish, like almost theatrically. Like I would see him on stage playing a villain like that, for
Yeah, I
sure.
was really super impressed with his acting this whole episode, which isn't saying anything different about his acting. He's always been on that level. It's just that this episode brought it into a greater contrast, I guess.
Wyndham and Leo have cemented Joxer inside of a chess piece. That would be Rusty Tomosky, in case some of you don't know who Joxer is. Wyndham prepares his crossbow and asks Leo for an arrow. Leo at first resists, but then is electrocuted by Wyndham, so Leo gets the arrow. Wyndham kills Joxer. Seems like during the short time that they've spent together that Leo and Rusty have formed a bond. Leo didn't want to get that arrow.
Well, it's a one-way bond. Leo didn't want to get the arrow because he didn't want that guy to get killed. But I mean, if you look at what Rusty's doing, he's kind of just like, "Hey, don't zap the geek. You know, he's spilling my beer. You know, you're supposed to give me the beer." So he cares more about his beer than
But
what's
then
going on with
he
Leo.
says, "Oh, that hurts."
Yeah, I guess that's true. I guess he cares about him a little bit, but it did seem like the beer was his paramount concern.
And for some reason, that dynamic right there made me feel like Rusty was Pauly Shore and Leo was
Brendan Fraser.
Brendan Fraser from Encino Man. Just that little small moment.
So, just before we go out of the scene, Leo's always been a villain character. He's had no problem trying to kill people or killing people, and he's had no problem doing any other of an assortment of nefarious deeds that you could get locked up for. But being in the presence of Wyndham Earl, who is supposed to represent, aside from Bob, or maybe along with Bob, he's kind of like an earthly representation of the ultimate evil mastermind. Now we see Leo turning to the good side. So he's a bad character that spends time around a worse character, and he starts to become good. Like the old Leo wouldn't have given a shit if, you know, Wyndham Earl put an arrow in that guy. He would have been like, "Whatever, I have to get back on the road. I've got shoes to buy." But now he's just like, no, I don't want to do that. Well, we know he gets to the point where he wants to save Shelley towards the end of the series. So, I mean, at one point he was trying to kill her not too many episodes ago. So there is a story arc or a character arc going on with him. We just don't, I'm just trying to kind of pick apart where it originates from. It has to have something to do with Wyndham Earl.
Well,
Maybe.
maybe because he's being the victim for once and he's developed some empathy for victims.
Oh, that's plausible.
That's all I can think of. So the Twin Peaks Judging Committee has gathered. It's Pete, Doc Hayward, and Mayor Milford, all the old crusty men of Twin Peaks.
Yep, who want to ogle all of the beautiful young ladies who are competing for the crown of Miss Twin Peaks, just like beauty pageants all across the land.
Ben Horn has requested to address them. Ben says that Miss Twin Peaks should be a celebration of the totality of a woman's qualities, not the jiggle fest it has been in the past. He is asking that the topic be about how to save their force. They say they will take it under advisement, and Ben walks away. Pete is the only one against the idea.
I don't know what the significance of that is.
What, Pete being against it?
Like why wouldn't Doc Hayward be against it? You know, especially, I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm getting ahead of myself because I know we're not spoiler free, but I'm just thinking about the fact that Donna's sitting however many tables away and she's kind of eyeballing this whole situation. You know, and we're going to find out that that's apparently Donna's, or yeah, Donna's dad. So you'd think there would be some animosity from Doc Hayward towards him, but there doesn't really seem to
There's
be.
not at all, so
At least not right now.
yeah.
I mean, I understand why Pete would not want that to happen. I mean, I get that because of the whole business interest, but it just seems to me like it would be Doc Hayward would have a little bit more to say about that, but he doesn't. He's on board with it.
Well, maybe Doc Hayward, likes the fact that Ben Horn's changing and wants to help encourage that.
Could be, yeah. He's that kind of guy. I mean, he's obviously forgiving, so.
So Ben walks over to where Bobby, Shelley, and Donna are seated and tells Bobby to not forget the dry cleaning, which is embarrassing for Bobby. And before walking away, Ben pauses to look at Donna. It's very obvious. He has no subtlety or
Yeah,
anyway, he just
subtlety would be the word. There's none of it.
and so he walks out and she watches him thoughtfully as he walks away. I don't really care about it, but
Well, we know where M stands on this issue. Well, you know, good Ben Horn is just as ruthless in his quest to be good as bad Ben Horn was in his ruthless in his quest to be bad.
Yeah,
So,
why would that change?
you know, the goal or the direction changes, but the means to get there and, you know, the general disposition doesn't.
That makes sense. It's part of his personality, I suppose.
Yeah, he's just like, well, I want this to come out because it's going to make me feel better about trying to be a good person. So I'm going to be obvious about it at every turn.
So now it is time for the contestants to approach the committee. Shelley is nervous. Bobby says he is going to write her speech. Unsurprisingly, this gives her no consolation.
Yeah.
Nadine arrives with Mike. Bobby pulls Mike away and asks for an explanation for his current relationship status. Mike gives him one that he whispers into his ear, but we do not get to hear it. But apparently, it's whatever happens when you have a combination of sexual maturity and superhuman strength. Any guesses on what he would have said?
No, I don't have any guesses on what he would have said. And the reason why, or you were hoping I would.
I'm really disappointed we didn't get to hear it.
I'm disappointed we didn't get to hear it, but I'm disappointed in the scene in general because this is the first time that these two guys have talked to each other since, I mean, they were thick as thieves back, you know, when the series was starting and there was all this, you know, stuff that was going on between them and everything and drugs and money and the whole nine yards and Laura Palmer's death and blah, blah, blah. So now their relationship is reduced to, hey, haven't seen you around. Haven't seen you around either. What are you doing with this old lady? Let me tell you. It's blah blah blah, and his exclamation of whoa, like shatters the concentration in the room, and everybody turns to him to look at him. But for the life of me, I cannot think of. I mean, this guy was dating Laura Palmer. I'm sure he's seen some deviant sexuality. It's not like they just did vanilla missionary stuff. You know what I mean? So I mean, there was cocaine, there was other people, there was all kinds of stuff that was probably going on. So it's like, what is it that Nadine would be able to unearth that would just blow your mind? So I'm kind of calling the bullshit card in this scene.
It is funny how he went straight over and played pinball, though. Like he had to
He had to get his
release some
mind off of
energy or
it.
something. Yeah.
That's like the bar equivalent of a cold shower. I'm going to the pinball machine.
So Harry is at the Packard household questioning Catherine about Josie. She tries to explain that Josie is someone or was someone who changed constantly to suit others around her, and she did it out of survival. Catherine shows Harry the box. Pete enters, saying "Wowee, Bob" about the contestants. Pete drops the box, which opens it re to reveal another box within, and on the box itself has phases of the moon as well as some other symbols that I'm not really familiar with.
One of them looked like a 69.
Sideways
Yeah, like a
69.
sideways 69. Like it was like two, or
Yeah,
I really, it could look at like two P's, really, 'cause.
I don't think that's what that is, but they almost look like astrological symbols again, but I don't know for sure.
I mean, I wasn't trying to
Because there
give
was
it.
like a almost like a Roman numeral two shape.
I wasn't trying to give it like a sexual connotation. It was more like an infinity
Sure.
type of thing or whatever. But I was torn with this scene because I felt like I liked Catherine's part in it, and I liked the fact that she was able to talk about Josie in a straightforward fashion that wasn't trying to get somebody else to think something bad about her. You know what I mean? She wasn't trying to poison Harry against Josie. I mean, which she could have easily done. She could have rattled off a bunch of real or imagined exploits and just made him even that much more forlorn about the whole situation. But instead, she was honest about it. And she was like, I curiously, I find it hard to hate her. And I just felt it was a nice scene on Catherine's part. And it kind of, I don't know where,
Humanizes her.
yeah, it humanizes her. And I don't know if they're trying to pull us in that direction or if they were just done with her whole, you know, arch villainous arc. And now they're just saving all of her fire breathing for Pete.
Yeah, Catherine's not hating Josie, and or when she says something along those lines to Harry, he says, "Well, she was so very beautiful." Like that somehow makes her harder to hate. I don't know what your thoughts are on that specifically, but I just want to point out that beauty is a theme. This episode is brought up a lot. You have Bobby talking about beautiful people can achieve anything and they don't get sent to the electric chair because that's his justification.
Okay.
And then, it cuts to Lana and she's using her beauty or whatever you want to call it to win the pageant. But anyway, so.
And there's the beauty pageant in general,
Right.
which is a overarching theme of this episode and the
Yeah.
ones before it and directly after it. So yeah, you're right. I guess there is a little bit of subtext to kind of talk about here. Beauty is the theme. And you know, you have the scene with Gordon Cole and Shelley where he's still just taken with her beauty to the point where he's going to kiss her because he's going to regret it for the rest of his life if he doesn't.
Comparing her to a goddess. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So beauty really runs through this. So, you know, even when Twin Peaks gives us an episode that isn't really all that great, they give us these little Easter eggs to try to find, you know, and I can't really say that for a whole lot of other shows, especially of that time period. So even if we're knocking an episode of Twin Peaks, we're not really bashing it, unless it's the one Diane Keaton did.
I know, that was hard. So Annie and Cooper chat while sitting in a rowboat on the lake. And it seems to me that Cooper is prying into her history.
Yeah, he's awfully quick to want to talk about that kind of thing. And Me personally, if I was ever in the dating scene again and I was dating somebody and something like that had happened to them, as long as they were over it, I might be okay if they never talked about it. Just because that kind of stuff is just it. Once you get into the nitty-gritty of it, I mean, man, you're reopening old wounds, and I don't know. It's a really thorny kind of area. But you're right. He does really just want to jump in there and get to the bottom of it. I mean, he's like grabbing her wrist and running his thumb over the scar and stuff like that, going basically just says, "So, why'd you try to kill yourself, girl? What the hell?"
She's got her skirt hiked up so her legs revealed. You notice that?
I didn't notice
Like
that.
she's sitting with her legs like not closed and one of her legs is up and their skirt is like pulled and you got like you can see part of her thigh.
Scandalous harlot.
Well, it's not that. It's just when you're getting to know somebody,
Go ahead.
I don't know. It just seems
It's violating some sort of rules of decorum to be able to do something
it
like
just
that.
No, it doesn't seem violent. It just seems very unnatural to be so laid back with someone that you're getting to know, and especially with a conversation like that, that's your it's not the right body language for it. If you're trying to hide something, why would you be really revealing something about your body at the same time? It doesn't make it
The
jars.
body language is conflicting with what's being said.
Yes.
Yeah. This just all goes back to the fact that I think we're all shippers to a certain extent with Cooper and Audrey, and we would have liked to seen that relationship happen. And now everything that we see Cooper do relationship-wise seems a little bit forced. And then when they actually give us a portrayal of a relationship with him and someone else on screen, it is forced. So that it just drives it home even more.
Right. I do, however, think some of the things she said is interesting because we already know that she knew about Owl Cave. She directed them there, and then whatever caused her to leave Twin Peaks was pretty devastating. And she said that she specifically needed to come back to the world, that she was frightened for so long, and that she had to face it, face herself where everything went so wrong. We've got doppelgangers, and she's talking about facing herself and what could be so frightening to make her run away and things like that. And I don't know what happened with the boyfriend, but
But it was in high school, though, which is crazy.
yes, like Laura was in high school.
So I guess in Twin Peaks, really bad shit can happen to you in high school.
Anyway, they kiss. It's awkward twice because they kiss and then they pull away and she says, "I really don't know you." And they kiss again. Then they exit the park, and Wyndham Earl watches with his binoculars.
Wyndham Earl and his fisherman's getup.
I know.
It's not even, I mean, it's barely a costume to begin with, if you know the body type of somebody. And then he's just staring there nakedly with no obfuscation of his face or anything like that. He's just looking at them. But you can pretty much tell what's going through his head at the time. It's like, no, Cooper's not going to be happy in a romantic relationship, not while I'm alive and breathing.
The wine tasting commences. Lana and Lucy help Dick pour the wines. Lana and Dick make eyes at each other. That's all I've written for that. I don't get too verbose about these wine tasting scenes.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot to say about this scene. It's just a lighthearted, funny kind of thing. I liked Andy and Dick in it, though. They were the highlights. When he's like helping him out, he's like, "There's also white
White
wines
wines?
and sparkling wines."
His earnestness is so cute.
It's endearing, but it just makes Dick, it just wants to like strangle him. And then when he actually gulps the wine down and stuff.
Dick loses his shit over
Yeah,
it.
he's yelling at him for it. He's like, okay. Then the way he regains composure. I mean, actually, Dick Tremaine is doing some of the best acting in this episode.
So Gordon and Shelley talk at the diner at a normal volume. Annie and Cooper arrive and are invited to sit with them before Gordon leaves Twin Peaks. Gordon requests a kiss from Shelley, and Bobby sees this and yells, "Hey, what the hell is going on?" Gordon tells him that you are witnessing a front three-quarter view of two adults sharing a tender moment. He acts like he's not seen a kiss before. Take another look, Sonny. It is going to happen again.
That's actually a pretty good imitation of Gordon Cole.
Was
Yeah, I mean,
it?
you would have to be a couple of octaves louder,
Yeah.
but the pronunciation was there.
That is probably the best Gordon Cole lines ever, in my opinion. Those are my favorite Gordon Cole lines. I'd completely forgotten about them, and I was
Yeah, they're
so
great.
happy to see it.
Three-quarter view.
And the look on Bobby's face was great.
And Shelley kisses him for a second time right in front of him, so.
Yeah.
Which I don't blame her. I mean, Cole's more of a catch than Bobby. mean, Bobby's a little more age appropriate, sure, but if you had to pick between the two of them, I mean,
Gordon Cole.
yeah.
As long as we could talk at a normal volume.
Well, you would be able to because you'd be
It'd
Shelley
be
Johnson.
Shelley, yeah.
Yeah. Gordon Cole actually has hobbies. He'd be an interesting person to talk to. Bobby's just trying to get rich by doing Ben Horn's dry cleaning. Give me a break. Come on. We don't see Norma in this whole episode or Big Ed,
No.
but when you've got the two main waitresses, Annie and Shelley, sitting at a table being served by another waitress who's obviously just an extra, that would have been the perfect time to have Norma in there. But apparently I guess she just wasn't contracted for that episode or something. Not really sure.
Yeah, who the fuck is that
Yeah,
waitress?
I mean somebody has to be working, obviously, because Norma's running the place, and her two main waitresses are just kind of taking the day off to do whatever.
You think it's Wyndham Earle in disguise?
It could be. It could
Cooper
be.
didn't sense him again.
Yeah, it's his best disguise yet as a
Yeah.
tall blonde. But why are two people who have the day off from the same job going to be there? Well, no, that's not fair to Annie because she was getting off work at the time and Cooper was picking her up. And maybe Shelley had just gotten off her shift and then Gordon was chewing her ear off. But I never understood why people hang out at their jobs when they're not working because I see it a lot. But
Well, maybe they get a free shift or
sure.
a cup of coffee.
I'd rather just buy my own beer.
So back at the wine tasting, Lucy is getting testy and suggests that they skip the wine and get a banana split. Lana and Dick continue to flirt. Lucy spits wine into Dick's face.
Because she's pregnant. I like the fact that when Dick is, smelling the wine, he comes out and his bandage is red at the tip. He's got the little Rudolph thing going on. He does a great job, but I mean, this scene is really, when you get down to it, it's a throwaway scene. It doesn't push the plot forward any further. It doesn't really do anything for
Yeah.
Twin Peaks in general. It's some characters that they don't really know what to do with having a goofy wine tasting. And it's fun to watch, but it's not integral.
Almost feels like this episode is a build up to what's to come because we have all the horn events that are about the pine weasel that's going to lead to the final beauty pageant, right? Where Annie gets kidnapped
Yeah.
and taken to the lodge. And then you have a lot of allusions just to the Red Room. You have red curtains behind the pageant committee, Doc Hayward, Pete, and Mayor Milford when they're sitting there. You also have Pete saying, "Wowie Bob," which makes me think of "Wow, Bob, wow."
Yeah, it does.
That has to be intentional. And then when Cooper comes and orders coffee, he says two black and two white, and that just makes me think of the black and white chevron tile. That's probably not anything, but it's interesting. That's the first time anybody's come in and ordered coffee, two black, two white. Like that.
Well, Mark Frost is writing with this episode, so he's not doing a great amount of stuff that you're really marveling at with the dialogue, but maybe he's throwing in these tidbits as just that's what you're getting out of this episode for his input.
At the Great Northern, Cooper is sitting before a fire. Wheeler sits with him, saying, "Love is hell." Cooper talks about his own heart being ripped out of his chest by a crowbar, but it's a good thing because his heart needs to be out in the open and loving somebody. Wheeler gets a telegram. He says, "Damn," and then asks the bellman to tell the front desk he needs to check out. He says goodbye to Cooper. The first time I watched this scene, I was annoyed with it, but it wasn't as bad the second time.
I actually like this scene all right. And it's funny because these two guys are in love with their respective girlfriends, or whatever you want to call them, their respective love interests. But they had the most, this the scene between them was the most honest heart to heart that I've seen between any of the four characters involved. You know what I mean? The two men speaking about how love is affecting them felt more heartfelt than any conversation between Cooper and Annie or Audrey and Wheeler. It also felt like this scene was true to the both of their characterizations because they're both sitting in front of a fire and Cooper's drinking what appears to be chocolate milk or maybe just a glass of milk
I thought it was just milk.
or maybe it's just milk, and then Wheeler has a shot of something.
How is that true to their characters?
That seems like something Cooper would do. He's not the type of guy who comes home and goes into the fridge and grabs a beer. He's a little bit more straight-laced than that. He doesn't, I don't know. I just don't see him being that kind of guy. But Wheeler is. He's the kind of guy who probably has a liquor bar in his house, and he's a little bit of brandy, a little bit of a bourbon, a little bit of scotch, maybe.
All
Not
mixed
at the
together.
same time. That sounded bad. That'd be horrible. Don't try that at home. So I guess I'm only saying that it's true to their characters because I'm looking at what they're drinking. So take it for what it's worth.
I'm just not buying either relationship, so I've just it's annoying.
I liked the scene, but I felt it was unnecessary. You know, as much as I did like it, it was unnecessary because if we don't understand at this point that those characters are being kind of torn apart by the new fresh love interest in their life, then we're just not paying attention. Of course, this was Wheeler's only scene in the whole episode, and Audrey wasn't present at all.
Yeah.
So that kind of made it a little bit strange.
So, dinner at the Haywards. The other sisters must be away at camp. Donna confronts her mom about Ben Horn. They have an enormous bowl of peas, and it's no wonder because Mrs. Hayward puts two helpings onto her plate.
She asks for the peas to be passed twice.
She loves peas.
Apparently.
That's why they have a big bowl of it.
It looked like what they had is some undercooked meat and a bunch of peas and some animosity
I like
on the
some
side.
peas, but I would never put a big ass bowl of peas on a table for
For
just three people.
three people, you know? I mean, I wouldn't have bowls of anything on a table for three people. You would just scoop it out of the pots that you cooked it in.
Do you think they're canned?
I don't know, 'cause I mean, besides canoodling with Ben Horn and doing charity stuff, I don't think Eileen has too much other things on her docket. She probably does cook from scratch, so she's shelling these peas.
So, as a way to deflect questions away from herself, Mrs. Hayward asks Donna about school. It's almost like she's like, "Oh yeah, well, how's school, Donna? I know you haven't been going. What about you? Let's look at you now."
You haven't been in school since earlier this season. I know that for a fact.
Donna tells her mother that she entered the pageant to win scholarship money so she can study overseas.
Snap.
Ooh, it's weird that Doc Hayward has to say, "I've worked the pageant for many years." It's like, well, duh.
I
We
mean,
why? How? Why would they not know that?
Not only would there not be a question of them not knowing it, but we already get it from the fact that he was on the committee in the first place. And you know, the way that you just get the impression that he's been doing this for a long time. And he has to say it at the table. I really don't get that.
I got a sense that Warren Frost was hiding his shame for that line when he said it. The actor himself knew that that was a shitty line.
Maybe Mark was pissed at his dad and he was just like, I'm going to make him say this. He's being a jerk. I'm going to give him the worst lines ever.
So, final scene involves the opening of the box at the gazebo. We have Rusty Tomosky dead inside the giant pawn piece. It's really overly dramatic with Cooper having to go up there and tie the do not cross tape up there and whatever and shoot the rock off. It's stupid. I think it's totally stupid.
I just don't see it working, you know. There's so many elements in play. I mean, even if you hit the rock at just the right angle and didn't ricochet off and hit somebody in the freaking face, you know, you could be thankful for that. If it pushes the rock away too fast, all that is crime scene tape. It's gonna snap. You know, it's not gonna pull that door open on its way out. I mean, it was pretty cool in a cartoonish kind of way. You know, like when people set up those weird contraptions, like a Tom and Jerry type thing, where, you know, the ball rolls down and then it hits this and it starts the burner that does that. And I don't know if that's Tom and Jerry or some other cartoon, but I think everybody out there knows what I'm talking about. But,
Didn't everybody else go hide behind the vehicles except for Cooper and Harry?
well, Andy told every, well, they had Andy tell everybody to get behind the police cruiser. So you're hoping that the ricochet wouldn't hit anybody, but I mean, you can't predict what that's going to do.
But Cooper and Harry do not go hide behind it when Cooper shoots the rock.
No, they go far enough away to where they feel like they're going to be out of the field of that, but still, I wouldn't risk it.
When Cooper was tying the tape to the box, it reminded me of the Man from Another Place, where when we see the Man from Another Place and we see him from behind and he's doing some sort of frenetic activity. Cooper looked like that to me a little bit when we're seeing it tying it, and we're seeing him from behind too. And I don't think it was intentional, but there was just certain things that were popping up in this episode that it kept reminding me of that other dimension or whatever you want to call it.
It's a good visual callback, even if it wasn't intentional. It's nice that it's there.
I mean, what do you think of Wyndham Earle's diabolical plan here to put a guy inside of a pawn piece?
Overkill. It's just not necessary. He's killing one more person, and he's letting them know next time I kill a person, it's going to be
Someone
somebody
you
you know.
know.
And it's not even attached to a corresponding chess move. They didn't even show, like, Pete. They have Pete on a scene where he's playing with the chess game. Okay, but he spends his time talking about Josie or trying to think of a poem about Chosie, instead of going, okay, this was Windham Earl's last move and a pawn was taken. Oh, great. You know, now we have to be on red alert for somebody's going to get killed. He just spends probably weeks on this, or at least days, on putting this guy in like what appears to be a papier-mâché pawn. I don't know. It was overkill. It was really overdone. But it was cool to see Ted Raimi. I mean, silver lining there.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like a Saturday Night Live skit, or the way he played the metalhead felt like something out of Saturday Night Live, and it definitely didn't have its place in the show. I wish he had played it a little bit more serious. I don't know if that was the direction telling him to play it like that, but.
I imagine it was, because part of that bad view that people have of metalheads from the late 80s and early 90s is because of writers and directors telling them to act that way. Thanks a lot, guys.
Well, that's all I have to say about this episode. Do you have anything else?
Nope, I think we covered it all.
All right, feedback.
Feedback time, feedback time. All right, time for feedback. First feedback is from Daniel. He says, "Hi, Em and Steve. Delving further into Indiana Jones territory, Windham Earl basically reveals himself to be a wacky Nazi this episode." Sorry, I just saw a little bit of Inglourious Basterds. Couldn't help it. He wants to find the mystic place of power, harness it, and reorder the earth to his liking. I know it's been said before, but it's still so crazy to compare this plot to the first part of the series when the goal was just to find out the horrific reason a troubled girl was murdered and catch her killer. Somehow, in the span of a few weeks, they went from a small town with big dark secrets to having to stop a former FBI agent harnessing the power of evil to take over the world." Yeah, it's quite a stretch. It really is. When you look at it that way, when you look at it how it started to where it got, and then you remember the fact that it's only been a matter of weeks, maybe, geez, if every episode is a day. There's one episode that's been a couple of days, but it wouldn't have even totaled out to a month at this point.
Right.
That's pretty crazy. I mean, if you lived in the town, that would either have to be par for the course, or you just have your mind blown on a daily basis. But you really wouldn't be privy to the knowledge of what Windham Earl's doing anyway. But still, it's kind of, yeah, we'll just move on.
I don't have anything to say about
Well, there's nothing to say. It kind of speaks for itself. Windham Earl's monologue about the history of the White and Black Lodge is a great example of the disappointment inherent when the show writers tell us about this stuff through heavy exposition rather than show us something open to interpretation like Lynch would. Agreed, for sure. I like it better when we can have our own interpretations of things, and it's a little bit more open-ended, because Windham Earl just kind of gives this long diatribe, and ostensibly he's talking to Leo, and then you have heavy metal guy, Rusty, listening
Right.
in.
And I liked what Windham Earl was saying. I thought it was eloquent, even though he's talking about horrible things.
It's cool as a mission statement, but I understand what Daniel's saying, that I also enjoy Twin Peaks when it's way more subtle.
It hasn't been subtle for a very long time, though.
That's true, yeah.
I
What are
think.
we expecting at this point? Because of the way the town of Twin Peaks feels so closed off, not just from the rest of the world, but even the time period of the early 90s, it feels really strange to see a character like Rusty Tomasky, Ted Raimi, just wander in. Also, every line out of his big dumb mouth, and especially that awful exaggerated death face, just bring the show down to a new sad low of camp. Hold on here. You can't talk crap about Ted Raimi. It's not allowed.
I understand what he's saying
No,
though,
I do
'cause
too.
I
I do
love
too.
Ted
I'm just
Raimi too,
kidding.
but like I said in the recap, it was like that was taken out of SNL and then juxtaposed next to something's more of a serious drama. It was jarring. It didn't
It
really
doesn't
fit
work
in.
and it doesn't fit at all. I love Ted Raimi. I'd love to hang out with him, have a beer with him, and I like to watch everything that he's in. But Twin Peaks was not a good fit for that. I didn't real like I said during the recap, I didn't realize he was in it. So when I finally saw it, I was like, "Holy shit, that's Ted Raimi. That's awesome." You know, somebody I like in a a show that I didn't remember that he was in. But I get what Daniel's trying to say. Twin Peaks seems to be in some sort of like time capsule up there in the Northwest, like immune to everything. You know, that the passage of time has just forgotten it. And here we have somebody who is of a very specific time and place, just kind of showing up out of nowhere, you know?
Well, they're just passing through Rusty Tomasky. I don't think he's from Twin Peaks.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah,
But
because isn't his friend in the next episode?
yeah,
Okay.
his bandmate. It just seems like season two has really played around a lot with tonal shifts. It's been
With
pretty
varying,
erratic.
degrees of success for
Yeah.
sure. Bobby is always trying to come up with some new get-rich-quick scheme. Even his blackmail scam fell through because now he's apparently being regulated to picking up Ben's dry cleaning. Why Bobby thinks that a local backwoods beauty pageant is going to propel Shelley and him into fame and fortune is beyond me. And he's back to being a jerk again. Gordon Cole to the rescue. Yeah, I didn't really think about it that way whenever he says it to her, when he's like, you win this and the sky is the limit kind of thing. And it's just like, well, what exactly are you going to do? What are you going to parlay that 15 minutes of fame into? You know,
thing is he probably would have more long-term success if he does continue to do the dry cleaning duties, because I think Ben believes in people starting and proving themselves, because he expected that of Audrey. And if Bobby were to continue with that, he may actually have success. It's just that he's just looking, as Daniel said, the get rich quick scheme. And he's just going to keep failing because he's an idiot.
Yeah, I could add a lot more to that, but I think you said it pretty well. an idiot.
It's just his rationalization for why beautiful people always succeed in life is because, have you ever seen one kid like put on the electric chair? It's like, that's your how you came to the conclusion was based on that fact.
It's a bad line anyway, because, you know, a beautiful blonde isn't going to be in the electric chair because she's going to have, it's going to be like a Wayne's World thing. She's going to have somebody else do the killing for her. So he's looking at beauty the wrong way. You know what I mean? Like, that it's not that she goes out there and murders someone and says, ha, because I'm beautiful, you're never going to catch me and punish me for this crime. That, you know, the beauty is going to be used in more subtle ways, and he's trying to handle it like a blunt tool, and he can't really do that. So, so when Cooper talks about the tingling sensation he gets while talking to Annie, and she says, that's interesting, doesn't it kind of remind you of how Audrey told Cooper, sometimes I get so flushed, yeah, it's interesting, and then asks him if his palms ever itch?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing I've been noticing with, I think, I don't know if it was last episode or the episode before, where they're putting Annie and Cooper through a similar arc that Audrey and Cooper went through, and then also Wheeler and Audrey as well. It's they were taking actual
lines that they had said?
Actual lines and
themes.
Moments. And putting these characters through that same trajectory. And so, yeah, and it's kind of, why couldn't they have their own way of forming a relationship? And maybe that's what's irritating us about it sometimes, is that it does cause us to remember, hey, remember when he had a more interesting relationship with somebody else? You're forcing me to remember that at the same time that you're forcing this relationship down my throat.
Yeah, agreed. Because, I mean, they do, you're right. You're absolutely right. They do try to do a lot of unnecessary callbacks, like the fact that, you know, the first time he meets Audrey, he's having breakfast. The first time he meets Annie, he's doing the same thing. I don't know if he's having breakfast per se, but coffee is involved.
Yeah.
So if they did have their own situation and it was allowed to develop a little bit more organically, I would be a little bit more forgiving of some of the stiffness that comes along with it. While Cooper reads poetry to Harry over coffee, suddenly Hawk bursts in and has not only already gone out and collected Donna's poem from her and found out Audrey's whereabouts in Seattle, but then Cooper makes him go and fetch Leo's arrest report. He deserves his own spin-off series called True Cop.
Yeah, I noticed all of this as I was watching it, and Daniel, you have forever changed how I view Harry and Hawk's working relationship.
Yeah, and until you pointed that out, and I've said this probably a dozen times over the course of the podcast since you have pointed it out, but before you pointed it out, I never thought about it. But Harry doesn't do shit. He's a bad cop. He's not good at what he does. And if he is, you would never know it, because he's always so busy doing something else that he doesn't need to be doing at that time.
It's almost like his role is commentary on bosses all over the world.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. They make their underlings do all the work, and then they get all the credit for it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Hawk should be running that station, and Harry should be going to the Double R getting coffee with Andy. True Cop. Somebody call HBO. Let's get that rolling. So did you garner any meaning whatsoever from the images of the cloaked figure with a star field inside them and then the owl and fire? I feel like they are implying that cloaked figure is the same one that was in the woods when Briggs was abducted. In the Log Lady intro for the Lynch-directed episode 9, Coma, she says, stars, moons, and planets remind us of protons, neutrons, and electrons. Is there a bigger being walking with all the stars within?
It's Morpheus from the Sandman comics. But there wouldn't be an owl. There would be a raven. would be Matthew. So it's not,
So
but
no.
that's it should
But
be, because then you've connected to the dreams and everything.
I feel like the importance of that being or character showing up, I also think it is, we talked about this earlier, I think in the podcast, and we talked about it beforehand too, but we think it's the same person who was standing there in the robe, or the same
Yeah.
representation that was standing there in a robe when Briggs was abducted. Speak English much. But as to its significance, I feel like it's a harbinger of the more mystical or metaphysical things that are to come in the next episodes, like
Maybe it's a
letting us
tear in the
know.
void
A
in the,
tear in the void,
yeah. Maybe it's
a wrinkle in time.
a humanoid representation of a tear in the void. I don't know. We'll see. It'll be interesting to see what David Lynch does with it.
Grr, how dare they use Audrey's Prayer as the background music for a Cooper and Annie love scene? Yeah.
Stepping all over Daniel's unrequited relationship between Audrey and Cooper.
It's not only that, but this has been pointed out before that whoever's using the scores for season two, whoever puts them in place, is doing things that are just completely and wholly inappropriate for those particular musical pieces. They're stealing them from season one. Instead of having Angelo Badalamenti get back in the studio and making new music for these particular scenes, they're just going, okay, well, we're going to take the music from this scene and transpose it to this one, and it cheapens it because you're going, wait a minute, these characters aren't even worthy of, what was originally intended for the musical score of that particular scene. I can totally see that.
By the way, Angelo Badalamenti has been confirmed for 2016.
Sweet. I didn't even think of that, but that's great. Oh, gives me chills just thinking about it. How many times have we played that soundtrack? It's ridiculous. All right. Now that they're all poured, first let us examine. Don't taste it yet, Andy. For heaven's sake, spit it out. I laugh out loud every time. The whole wine tasting event is pure filler, but I still enjoy watching Dick, Andy, and Lucy all making complete fools of themselves. Agreed. I think we said something similar in the podcast itself because we were talking about how this scene is just completely unnecessary, but it's fun to watch though,
I wonder when Lucy was spitting in her wine if she was trying to soak his nose bandage, trying to redden the whole thing. Yeah, it was enjoyable because sometimes their storylines tend to get a little bit too silly, but this one was enjoyable to watch.
The fact that Bobby has to watch clearly just makes Gordon's kiss even sweeter to Shelley. That's one of the best moments in the entire series. Apparently, that was a last-minute addition to the script. Lynch told Harley Payton to add. In an interview with the fanzine Wrapped in Plastic number 17, he said, quote, David wouldn't really read scripts until the night before they were to be shot. So then he would call in and say, really, you ought to do this, this, and this. And the director would say to me, you can't do this. It's ruining everything I've planned. I would call up Mark and say, Mark, you've got to talk to David because I'm not going to do it. I'm going to tell the director to do what he has planned. But Mark would say, no problem, I'll talk to David. But then, because Mark was working on his own movie at the time, he never really had a chance to talk to David. So David would blame me for not carrying out all the changes. It got pretty ridiculous. At one point, David wanted us to write a scene so that he could kiss Machen Amick, as Gordon Cole. So I wrote a scene where there was that occurring, and I wrote the lines for Dana Ashbrook to say, why would you want to kiss that really old guy? Unquote. So that never appeared in the actual script at any point. We never had Bobby Briggs saying that. It's just the kiss as it was. So that's interesting that, see, if you've ever worked a job where there's a chain of command, I'm not just talking about like military and stuff like that, but when one person is supposed to tell another person something to kind of get you off of the hook or to relay that message because that's the way that the order of things goes, and the middleman doesn't do their job. So then the person at the bottom does what they think they're supposed to be doing, and then the person at the top is like, why the hell didn't you do what I say to do? And it's like, well, because this guy was supposed to talk to you and tell you that that can't happen, and then everything gets all screwed up just because somebody doesn't do what they're supposed to do. It's kind of like that whisper game you would play when you were a kid. Remember that?
Yeah, I heard it through the grapevine.
So the link is vital. Anyway, actually, in that same interview, he had some other illuminating comments about the difficulty of mid to late season two from his perspective that you might also want that you might also find interesting. Quote, "We had this big problem. When we revealed who killed Laura Palmer, the show would be over. We needed to figure out something that would take the place of that. Mark and I figured out the best thing would be to have Cooper become passionately involved with Audrey, to have a big affair. That was what all our mail was about, and that's where it was all headed. It seemed like a great thing to do next, to have that love affair carry for the show, or I'm sorry, to have that love affair carry the show for about 6 episodes. We had it planned, but unfortunately Kyle refused to do it. So we ended up with no second season. All we had were backstories. Every story that you saw for those first 5 episodes was meant to be a secondary and really unimportant story. Suddenly, that was all we had, and we had nothing to replace it with." Well, that goes a long way to explain a lot of season two, honestly.
Little Nikki.
Little Nikki, yeah. Thanks. Thanks, Kyle MacLachlan, for bringing us Little Nikki, just because you didn't want to have an on-screen romance with... I mean, why wouldn't you want to have an on-screen romance with...
Was that in the first 5?
I don't remember if it was in the first 5. It doesn't seem like it. It seems like it was a little later.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, that was going to be their meat and potatoes, and they could kind of build their the rest of their plate around that, and they didn't, you know. And regarding the character of Annie, he didn't mince words. So this is from the same interview. "Yeah, the one who was the saint. She came out of a nunnery. It was ridiculous. It was just a mess. And once Kyle was allowed to do that, all the actors felt like they should determine their storylines too. Why does Andrew get to get up? If he gets up, we'll all get up. It'll be anarchy." It's a good point. You have to have rules to this kind of stuff. You can't just say, like, look, you're the star and you have this power, so you can decide what the writers are going to write for you or not. That's bullshit, really. I mean, your job is to come in there and do what they have designed for you to do. And I love Kyle MacLachlan. I like him in everything that I've seen, except maybe Showgirls, which is just a piece of crap. But, you know, I mean, I don't know. I think I like it when actors have enough respect for the writers and directors that they work for, the people who are generating their paychecks in the first place, that they do what they're told to do. And I think it's cool when there's a give and take, when the actor comes up to the director or the writer and says, hey, listen, here's my input on this. Maybe we could play it this way because I feel like it would be more effective. Then they take that into consideration. A little give and take starts to come across, and then we get a better product as the viewer. That's great. But when you have somebody putting their foot down and saying, I'm not going to do this, then we end up with what we end up with in season 2 of Twin Peaks. You know, I don't know how much better it would have been, because Laura still, the whole Laura thing has already been prematurely cleared up, and that was probably the biggest draw. So, but still, I think it would have been better.
It still doesn't explain why, you know, there's other characters that have just been completely dropped, as Daniel pointed out last episode, like Sarah Palmer. You know,
yeah.
I mean, why didn't they think of making use of those characters and still, like, focusing around the mystery of those people?
I mean, what's Sarah Palmer been doing this whole time? Just sitting in her living room staring at the place where Bob had appeared, smoking cigarette after cigarette, pulling her hair out?
Where's Philip Gerard?
Yeah, where did he go? I mean, he disappeared right after a pretty pivotal scene, and there was no follow-up to that. Daniel continues, I don't know if it was deliberate, but the scene where Wheeler and Cooper chat about love by the fire has always felt to me like the writer's way of formally passing Audrey's torch from Cooper to Wheeler and showing that there won't be any conflict between them. Once again, though, I have to say, calm down, people. You only just met these girls a few days ago. It really does make me cringe seeing characters who are supposed to be worldly, grown men acting like schoolboys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and once again, it's that whole time in the real world and time in the Twin Peaks world. Because if you took these relationships and timed them out the way that we were seeing them week by week by week, that would be enough time for somebody to feasibly fall head over heels in love with someone else, or at least to have a pretty severe case of infatuation, right? But we're talking like 3 or 4 days in some instances here. That's just pushing it. At the Haywards' dining table, there are no places set for Donna's 2 sisters at dinner. Where are they? It's really creepy. Also, Eileen asked Donna to pass the peas twice, and did you see how gigantic that bowl of peas was?
Yes. She must love peas. I already said that earlier.
But yeah, we kind of commented on this one earlier, but
for trying to give a charitable explanation, there it is.
It's bad writing and it's bad editing. I mean, who approved the script that has her asking to pass the peas twice and then has the peas in a giant bowl in the first place? And
it's just, I guess, to show how, like, discombobulated she was by Donna's line of questioning.
Perhaps, yeah. I guess if we're being charitable, we can do that. Like, she asks the same question over again. That,
yeah. You know.
Next time, it will be someone you know. How much more impact would there be if it was someone we know this time?
Like if it was Pete, since he was the one like helping them with the chess game.
Oh, man. See, that would have really hit home.
I would hate it, though.
I would hate it, too, because, I mean, they really didn't do a whole lot with Pete's character. And unfortunately, you know, Jack Nance has passed away, so he won't be back for 2016. But it still would have been a gut punch to us. But nobody cares about Rusty, you know? The only person who cared about him was Leo. And Leo's got a shot caller, so. He says, hope you two have a damn fine week, Daniel.
You too, Daniel.
You too. Thanks a lot for writing.
Thank you.
Next up, we have John Bernardi, who says, yes, I'm writing from work. The very first scene I ever saw of Wyndham Earl was his pale face and blacked-in teeth as he's holding the mayor and Leo hostage right before the Miss Twin Peaks contest. I had no context of him other than he was able to capture the major and a spouse abuser, and he looked like he was from the Lodge. So the 13-year-old me was perfectly comfortable being scared by this guy. I wish everyone could have met Earl like I did, because when I finally watched his introductory episodes, I was able to see him as way more than a Batman 66 villain, and it makes his big speech about the White and Black Lodges so much more interesting, too. That would have been a cool way to be introduced to Wyndham Earl.
Yeah.
Because we got the goofy costumes and we got this build-up, and then you get the actual delivery, and you're like, this guy's not scary at all. The only person who should be scared of him is Leo, because he's got a shock collar on. And I guess any metalheads that are lured out of the wilderness with the promise of beer. I think it's a shame that the writers didn't give him any gravitas before this scene happened, because all the Lodge talk could have been as creepy and awesome as I think it is. I think Kenneth Welsh did a great job with the delivery overall, and really, he does a great job with his acting every time he's on scene. It's just sometimes Diane Keaton asks him to go completely Looney Tunes.
Yeah.
So now it's part of Earl's canon that he's a prancer and more than a bit of
right.
comic relief, which really stinks for the guy who's supposed to be the biggest bad since Bob.
Because the whole time I've been listening to you read this, his letter right here, I've been thinking about, yeah, but the flute, playing the flute in his thermal underwear.
So, you know, we can kind of pass off the Diane Keaton episode as a little bit of artsy quirkiness, but it left a legacy because now that character, that was his first real big reveal. After his initial reveal, that was the first episode where you really had him, you know, interfacing with another character.
Right.
And you got to see who he was. And he was this just completely off-the-wall bastard. So now, no matter what else he does, he has to keep an element of that. So
off-the-wall bastard.
I was being a little bit snarky earlier when I said, thanks a lot, Diane Keaton. But now I really mean it because I had never thought of that before. But John brings up a really good point there. Because you have to keep a little bit of that or else it's just going to seem incongruent if you drop all those characteristics. They really should leave the comic relief to Dick Tremaine. I've grown to love the campy side of Twin Peaks, Dick in particular. I know he's essential to the... I know he's essentially the shine on the turd of C... of C plots turned A and B plots, but his smarm sells the hell out of that crap.
Yeah.
I really hope he's in the new episodes. Ian Buchanan was one of the leads on the air, so I bet both Frost and Lynch would love to have him back to redeem the character officially. Agreed. They should leave the funny stuff to him. And, you know, a little bit of the banter between Andy and Lucy has always had that comic goofiness to it, too. But as far as a character that embodies that, you know, since you're not going to have Dr. Jacoby on the show anymore for whatever reason, then...
I know. That's another character they could make use of.
Speaking of the campy side, I know someone's already quoted the Gordon Cole line he says to Bobby, so I won't retype it here, but I love, love, love that scene. Whenever I think about Twin Peaks, I invariably recall this as one of my fondest of the whole show. If you've got it in you, gush for me some more on this, please. We do actually have it in us, John. We do. Anytime Gordon Cole comes on the scene, I love it. I feel like it's actually Twin Peaks again. No matter how left field that season two could take us, when you get Gordon Cole back, it brings it back to that center to me.
I mean, it was a great moment for Shelley's character to have someone tell her something like that. So you had everything we've seen her go through with Leo and then with Bobby, and then to have a character we really like and respect, Gordon Cole, say something so awesome. And also, we got to see Bobby be insulted.
Yeah.
It hit all these great spots all at the same time. I don't know if I can gush enough or gush well enough for this, But like I said earlier in the recap, I had forgotten about this for some reason, and it brought me great joy to see it again, and I can't believe I forgot it.
I've always really liked Shelley's character. And, when she was doing, I mean, she's, I have a really bad sense of humor that you guys don't really hear on this podcast because I save it for work. It's horrible. A lot of people would think I'm a bad human being if they heard me say some of the jokes that I say. But, when Shelley was doing the thing in one of the first episodes where she's doing the little finger puppet and imitating Leland as he's going up and down on the coffin, and she's laughing about it to the two guys that are eating and stuff. Like, I always thought that was hilarious. And it was this nice snarky side to her personality. But I've always really liked Shelley, and I feel that Leo never gave her the respect that she deserved. Obviously, he's a spouse abuser. And I don't think that Bobby has ever given her the respect that she deserves. Each of these guys has tried to use her as a tool. One of them is their ticket out of Twin Peaks. The other one was their maid and housekeeper. And Gordon Cole is here being a perfect gentleman to her and telling her how beautiful she is without any strings attached to it. He doesn't want her to do his laundry or to get him out of Twin Peaks or to win anything or to even sleep with him. He just wants a kiss, and I think it's a really sweet and special scene between them.
And I think it's awesome that Shelley kisses him right in front of Bobby.
Yeah, I think
So
so
great.
too, because Bobby deserves that. She should get that kiss, and Bobby deserves to have to see that. I hope that was enough gushing for you. Also, one of my all-time favorite scenes is that quiet scene at the fireplace between John Justice Wheeler and Cooper. Ah, somebody else who likes it. I did like this scene, as I mentioned in the
I
recap.
didn't. I mean, it was
So
better on rewatch, but I didn't like it the first time. I was annoyed.
I felt like the writing of it was good. I do agree overall with Daniel that these are grown men who've seen a good bit of the world, so it's like you're infatuated with somebody right now. So just get over it. You're acting like your heart's been being drug around behind you for 10 months. That's not what's going on here. But I still did like the scene, so I agree with John on this.
Well, one thing I could say about the scene is that Cooper did have a positive look about love, where Wheeler did not. Like his was more about pain, and Cooper was more about the release of his heart, talking about his heart being released by a crowbar, right?
Yeah.
I think because Cooper is probably more confident in some ways, but also because he knows that the love is returned, where Wheeler doesn't really know that for sure from Audrey at this point.
I think it's part of their personalities too, because Cooper is exuding this positive optimism with his glass of milk, and Wheeler is kind of exuding the doppelganger version of that with his negative cynicism and his little tumbler or his shot of liquor.
That's better. I like that much better.
So that's what they're doing. They're playing opposite ends of the spectrum with that. They're both
Right.
affected by love in different ways, but it affects them in terms of how their personalities already interpret all of these external stimuli, if you will. John goes on to say their philosophies as men in Deep is delivered so well, great character work that didn't need to be in the show, but I'm so glad it was. Billy Zane is actually subtle on this show, and yes, I'm purposely looking the other way for that singing cowboy scene. I had no idea that Billy Zane knew what subtle meant. Oh, man.
Oh.
Much less be able to pull it off. But I really enjoy how this character could honestly be meant for Audrey, given some time when he gets back from his out of town business. Put a cork in it, Zane.
Haven't seen Billy Zane in a lot of stuff, so.
Really, I've seen him in this. I've seen him in Zoolander as a very, very bit part, and then he was in Titanic.
Yeah, I think that's all I've
So
seen.
unless I've seen him in something and I didn't realize it was him years and years ago, that's my but yeah, he does have subtlety included in his repertoire of range, but I guess he doesn't pull it out much. And I think that sucks sometimes for actors and actresses who are really good look who are really good looking. They're not asked to be that subtle all the time. All right, you ready? Which makes me extremely sad about Annie. While they were giving Wheeler and Audrey some room to turn into something in the future when he comes back in the future, Cooper gets paired with a wooden character, and I can't take an apologist turn for her no matter how hard I try. I can see why Cooper would enjoy her oddball, pure as fresh fallen snow thing, but not how he'd fall for her so completely and quickly that 6 episodes later he'd get possessed by Bob for her. She was basically a shell in that final 2 episodes, so I was extremely curious about her character in the 4 years between then and seeing Annie's introductory episodes for the first time. I had built her up into something almost mythic that Cooper must have lost his mind over. Instead, I find out that Annie's one of two things, a perfect, long-simmering kind of relationship that should have advanced slowly over the course of at least an entire season before blooming properly, like, say, Audrey would have been by then, or she's a good match who tragically turns into what essentially becomes a rebound girl after the Audrey chemistry got flushed. I'd love to end on something a little more uplifting, but my lunch break is basically toast, so I'll go outside the show and make it about you. Thanks for putting out your show weekly, even over a big holiday weekend. I know it's not nothing to put together a podcast, and here you are being extremely professional. Much appreciated. And in that vein, I've always been curious. Who does your theme music? It's a catchy homage without being derivative, and I'd love to find out how you nabbed it. Take care, John.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. That's very high praise. I appreciate that. We if nothing else, we strive to be professional about our timeliness. M is a stickler for that, especially. And she puts in probably 95% of the work that you hear on these podcasts because she does the recap, except for the odd occasion where I do it, which is not very often, as you've heard. And that entails watching the show at least two times, if not more. And then after we do the actual podcast, she does all of the editing to make it sound good. So it takes out all the parts where I'm making these bad jokes that people really don't want to hear, you know, and things of that nature. And, you know, she works a job where she has weekends off. I work a job where I work on weekends because I'm in the service industry. And so even though it is a holiday weekend and stuff like that, we still try to stay on schedule mm-hmm. because people don't care about what's going on in our personal lives. Yeah. They want to hear their podcast. I mean, we do another podcast on Vikings called The Wild Hunt, and not this last season, but the season before that, there was a episode where we tried to record in a different studio over at Paul's house, and the sound files kind of got lost in the cloud, so to speak, for a number of hours. And I think Paul and M were up texting each other and trying to figure this out on the computer until what, 1 or 2 in the morning?
Yeah. And then the sound was all jacked up too, and I had to work on that. It was crazy. We'll just sum it up there. It was a lot of fucking work.
So, you know, we're not here going, oh, we worked so hard or M worked so hard or anything like that. But a lot of work does go into it, and it's we do it because if we were listening to a podcast on something we really liked, we would probably expect it to be delivered in a timely fashion. So right. We just kind of try to do the same thing.
And that's what I was gonna at some point interject here is say I listen to a lot of podcasts, and there are some that I get into a schedule with, and it becomes my ritual on certain days to listen to this particular podcast on my way to work or whatever. And so I understand that as being a podcast listener, so that's why I like sticking to a schedule. As far as the intro song, I get all of our intro music for all of our podcasts from Pond5 because I don't want to, you know, get in trouble for copyright issues.
Infringements.
Copyright infringements.
But Pond5 is a great website.
Yes. Yeah, you just type in if you're ever looking for something. Like, I don't think that one costs that much money. Our Penny Dreadful intro is really badass, and I paid a little bit more than I normally would for an intro song.
But it's worth it.
It's so awesome. We cover Penny Dreadful as well.
Yeah, if you guys like the show Penny Dreadful, check out our Demimon podcast, because it's really good.
Anyway, just to keep this short, yeah, I'll get back to you on that because I don't have the information right in front of me while we're recording right now because I hadn't read your email, so I didn't know you were going to ask that. But I will announce it next time on our podcast. But yes, all from Pond5.
At any rate, thank you for writing and thank you for the compliments. It's humbling.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to hear that, and you know, gets me motivated to do more, and I love hearing that.
And keep writing, because we love to read what you have to say about these episodes on air. This is most of the fun for us, actually. So.
Yeah, I know it takes a lot of time to write these emails, and especially you're doing on your lunch break when you know, possibly could be doing something else that's a bit more relaxing. So, you know, thank you for doing that.
Ready? Mm-hmm. Next up, we have Tyler. Here we go again. Right off the bat. Oh, about Wheeler's tucked-in sweater last week. I thought I had wrapped my millennial mind around 90s fashion, but I must have much yet to learn.
You do.
you do, but you're never going to learn it, because I was born in the 70s, and when I look at 70s fashion or even early 80s fashion, yeah. It's just, I can't wrap my head around it. I'm like, you can't tell me that that looked good, you know, and I see the way my parents dressed me in old pictures and stuff like that. I'm like, what the fuck? What are you thinking? You know, it doesn't, it just, it's a generational thing. And once you've passed from that generation or that decade or that specific, you know, finite period, it never comes back. You can never see why it was a good idea at the time.
It's all
But I guarantee you,
contextualized.
it's all contextualized. Exactly. It's all very situational and time relative. So if you were watching it at that time as a teenager, you wouldn't think anything of it. I mean, I remember watching Beverly Hills 90210 when it came out. And remember Andrea's glasses, how big they were?
Yeah.
I didn't even like bat an eyelash at that. You know what I mean? I thought she was totally hot, which she was. But I mean, I wasn't thinking, wow, she has huge freaking glasses. But by today's standards, I mean, they're rather large spectacles. So don't worry about it, Tyler. You can try to wrap your head around it, but nothing's going to happen. The Log Lady intro is all about pie on the surface, but underneath, it's about hoping that the people you admire and respect also like you, even when you do things you're not proud of. Using Norma as an example, and the log lady regretting leaving her pitch gum on the counter. It also mentions that Twin Peaks has famous huckleberry pie in addition to cherry. Have we ever heard that before? Yes, we have. Major Briggs says it at one point. I don't remember if it's to Bobby when they have their special scene at the R&R, or if he says it to Cooper or somebody, some other major character, but he says, try the huckleberry pie. It's especially good today.
Or especially fresh.
Or especially fresh. Yeah, I think it might
I
be
think it
especially fresh.
was Bobby.
But he does, I do know for a fact that the words huckleberry pie come out of Briggs's mouth in a very appreciatory fashion. Wyndham Earl finally gives us his mission statement, but unfortunately, it's to heavy metal guy. That's Rusty to you, Tyler. That's Rusty. Or Ted Raimi to us, to Joxer the Mighty. Yeah, we touched on this with some of the other feedback and some of our own thoughts. It's pretty heavy-handed, but at least you know exactly where he's going from here. There's no like maybes or anything like that. You know what he's going to be doing
What do you mean?
as far as Wyndham Earl.
Oh, okay.
Beautiful people get whatever they want. Ha ha. Bobby is at it again. It's funny to me that his example of this bias is not getting the electric chair. Not exactly the pinnacle of ambition.
See?
Aim high, Bobby. Aim high. If I'm beautiful, I'll never get fried in the electric chair, no matter what I do. Screw being a good person or trying to accomplish something with your life. The first time I watched this, I was so excited to hear Cooper say, "Putting the pieces together, Harry." Yeah, it harkens back to the old Cooper, the Cooper of old, I guess I should say, first season Cooper. Like he's getting something done, and we're moving towards a conclusion.
And he's smiling when he says it. Yeah, it's like the excitement of being on the case again.
Are FBI agents trained to study handwriting, or is this a Cooper thing? He's done it once before when he flirted with Audrey in season one. I don't know. I would imagine that they probably have some rudimentary training and all that kind of stuff. You know, but I think that would be a specialized field to be an expert in. I think Cooper's just one of those people who he pays attention to details a lot. And it would be something that would kind of occur to his meticulous mind.
He's got to have a photographic memory.
Yeah, he probably does. I mean, they don't mention it. They don't make it a part of his character, but I could totally see that. It's almost like the heavy metal guy walked into Twin Peaks from any other 90s TV show and just doesn't understand danger or weirdness. He's even laughing up until seconds before his death. Yeah, the campiness of this scene is pretty much just.
I read it as nervous laughter, where because he wasn't quite sure if Wyndham Earl was being serious or not. And I think he felt that way until the arrow hit him.
Yeah, I can agree with that. Like he's like, what are you doing, dude? What's going on
Yeah.
here? Yeah, heavy metal guy, not really a favorite with the feedback writers tonight, but
Don't blame them.
I don't blame him either. Upon seeing every other woman in town enter Miss Twin Peaks, I have to wonder why they would have had. I have to wonder, would they have had Josie enter it if she was still in the show? Good question.
Can't see Josie entering that though.
It seems like, I guess the whole beauty element would be there because they keep kind of trying to pound it into our heads how beautiful she is, especially anytime Harry opens his mouth about it. But
But she's one of those beauties that doesn't have to prove it. You know what I mean?
right. She doesn't need a plaque
It's
on the
like
wall.
it's almost like she rises above that. And this is despite your feelings about her, but there was a sophistication about her, a gracefulness, a movement, and women like that, I can't imagine her in a pageant.
As much as I dislike the character, I actually honestly agree with what you're saying, and I think it would have been perceived to be beneath her to even enter into that
Right.
competition.
That's what I think too.
Yeah. Wow. We agreed on that. Awesome. I'm glad Bobby was like, "What are you doing, bro?" to Mike, but he ended up on Mike's side. I hope we learn that Mike had a very fun time in a fraternity directly following Twin Peaks. It's all I can picture for him and Nadine. College, the next frontier. I really want to like the nature study on the lake. I'm an Annie apologist after all, and I still can't do it. Oh, Jesus. If
Oh
you're an Annie
no.
apologist and you still can't come up with something positive about that scene, it's a bad scene. It's stiff. It's like you had mentioned him about how she's sitting there with her leg open.
Yeah, conflicting messages.
This is some of Annie's most wooden portrayal. I think Kyle MacLachlan carries a performance, but neither of them really knows how to make this scene work. The dialogue is pseudo deep and doesn't sound like the way people talk, so I think part of the blame is on the writers here.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, there was no conversational tone to this. It was just two people woodenly being in love. They were like Pinocchio puppets, Well, I can help you with that, Miss Annie.
And the fact that she called her ex-boyfriend that boy, that's really weird.
Yeah, we used to make fun of this guy that we worked with because he was in his early 20s and he would refer to people, "Oh, my one ex, so and so," and we'd be like, "Wait a minute, we haven't heard of her. Who is she?" "Well, I dated her when I was 13." She's not your ex when you date her when you're 13. An ex has to be somebody significant in your life. Yeah, I mean, by the time you get into your 20s and you talk about exes, unless you say my ex-girlfriend or an old girlfriend, if you just say ex and then say something about that person, we're going to assume that you're like ex-wife. So
What I'm trying to say is that if she had a serious enough relationship with this person, even though they were seniors in high school, like Bobby and Laura were,
right.
I mean, would Laura call Bobby a boy? Probably not. And so you when you at that age, you don't see each other as a boy and a girl. It's man and woman. So for her
Exactly.
to, and even in your memory, I think you still see them in that way.
Yeah,
So for
it's a
her to
very
like reflect.
condescending term.
Yeah, for her to reflect on him and say that boy, and I think that's a problem with writing as well.
Yeah, because it's unreal. You're exactly right. That's unrealistic because if you're looking at that, because when I think back of to relationships when I had in high school or something like that, I don't think I dated this young girl because I was a young boy. We were both 15. I just think I dated this person.
Right. And I'm just supporting what Tyler's saying that the writing was off.
Yeah, I agree. So that they had very little to work with, but they still didn't seem to be able to do much with it, even with their combined acting talents. Dick Tremain's wine tasting feels like a YouTube clip in the best way. It has absolutely nothing to do with the plot or even the Ghostwood subplot, but it's funny nonetheless. Yeah, it was a nice little detour. Usually I'm pretty derisive of the comic relief stuff in Twin Peaks when it doesn't have anything to do with the main plot, but this one gets a pass. I think everybody so far in feedback has commented on it. I think it's kind of like a guilty pleasure for a lot of Twin Peaks fans, the wine tasting in season two. All right. Gordon Cole talks normal volume to Shelley. I like how this turns into a double date as well. Did you have anything to say on
No, we've already gushed about that scene. Sorry,
that?
Tyler.
Yeah.
That's a great scene.
They finally actually give up on chess, which is good since it has been a little half-hearted lately. I would say half-assed, but
I mean, there wasn't any. Wait, Pete wasn't even really playing chess.
yeah, he was too worried about singing a song to Josie to
And then you
really.
have that pawn with the heavy metal dude in it.
It's like the
But.
chess motif of the last several episodes has been like very much a case of style over substance and.
Definitely.
And as a chess player, it's annoying, so I'm glad we're done with it. Playing off the board, Tyler. Thanks for writing, Tyler.
Thank you,
Appreciate it.
Tyler.
Our last piece of feedback tonight is from Joel. Stephen M. Well, now I'm sure you remember who Heavy Metal Dude is. Yes, we do. Lucky you. Some interesting tidbits about the late Rusty Tomasky. He is played by Sam Raimi's brother, Ted. And a heavy metal band has actually devoted an entire track on their album to this obscure character. Yeah, we listened to the YouTube clip that Joel sent us, and I vaguely remember this band's name from
It's Hammer Lord.
Hammer Lord. I remember it's like a late 80s, obviously into the early 90s band in that time frame, but I never listened to them. But you can it's just kind of general run of the mill thrash metal. Nothing
But
too
with the
spectacular.
vocals are a little bit different, you said, than what you would expect with thrash metal, right?
Yeah, it wouldn't be Bay Area thrash metal. That's San Francisco Bay Area thrash metal. So it didn't sound like, say, Testament or Death Angel or Forbidden or something like that. But it had that thrash metal feel from the late 80s into the early 90s. But the vocals almost had like a New York hardcore element to it. But this is really neither here nor there. But I can go on about this kind of crap forever.
He can.
I have on occasion.
He has.
Another Twin Peaks podcast pointed out the incongruity of cutting from this absurd dead face with the tongue sticking out inside a giant pond to the show's original murder victim, Laura Palmer, whose portrait is still under the end credits. This character is a complete goofball and would have felt very out of place early in the show, but at this point, I just kind of accept and enjoy his complete ridiculousness.
It's really all you can do at this point, you know.
Yeah, you don't have another choice. There's no other avenue you can really go down besides abandoning the show and saying fuck it. But
In some ways, it's because we know Twin Peaks is coming back in 2016. I feel like I can be more forgiving because I know there's going to be a turnaround. And so all this stuff I can kind of take with a grain of salt and just enjoy it for what it is because I know there's going to be something that's going to satisfy these other needs that I have for the show. So if it wasn't coming back, I would be probably pretty pissed about
See,
all
you're
of
saying
this.
that because you know that there's going to be more of it, you can judge it a little bit less harshly. But
Right.
if season two was the last will and testament of Twin Peaks, which we've thought it was for the longest time, you kind of judge it on a lot more harsher plane.
Right.
Yeah, I can see that. As far as the juxtaposition between Rusty Tomasky's face and then Laura Palmer's portrait, I really thought that they should have gotten rid of, and this has been commented on by listeners before, and probably talked about us at length, so I'll keep it short. But I really feel like Laura Palmer's portrait should have been deleted from the end scenes a long, long time ago. And it really brings it. Most of the time, I don't really notice or care, but then it gets. The point really gets driven home in an episode like this, when you have this dead person, and then you have another dead person, and then you start to think of the juxtaposition of those two dead people faces and what each one represents to the show, and you're like, Jesus
And
Christ.
how their deaths were treated,
Yeah.
you know, and it just shows how the show has really changed over time. And like I think people have already said, and you have said that it feels like a different show.
It does, yeah. This is a strange little episode. It is the first time Mark Frost has written a teleplay in 10 hours of television. His last contribution was Leland's death, and his next will be the finale. I'm not sure why, as this doesn't strike me as a particularly important episode. The previous one restored Cooper to the FBI, and the next one will do most of the heavy lifting to set up the Black Lodge finale. So I'd be interested to know why Frost chose this episode to overtly contribute to. Maybe it just coincided with an opening in his Storyville pre-production schedule. It may or may not be worth noting that while Frost usually partners up with both Peyton and Engels, this time it's just him and Peyton. I have read slash heard stuff suggesting that by the end of the series, the writers were sort of divided into two camps or alliances, Frost and Peyton on one side and Lynch and Engels on the other, the latter of whom would go on to write Fire Walk With Me together. That's really interesting. Actually, that kind of brings everything into a little bit more of a clear, I guess, vision of it. It makes sense why you have a lot of meandering to this, but it doesn't really answer the question as to why Frost would decide to contribute to this episode and not really bring his A game to it. Because, like you said, the last one that he did was Leland Palmer's death, which was an ace episode. And then the next one he's going to do is the series finale, which is also another ace episode. So if you're going to bother to do anything at all in the interim,
Maybe there's some things lost in translation, you know, because a lot happens after the page has been written and given to a director and everything like that. And
Yeah.
you know, I don't know.
So you're trying to be charitable and saying maybe that there was a little bit there was a little bit more on the offering, but it kind of got whittled down for the sake of time or just ease of storytelling, perhaps.
Maybe.
That sucks if that's the case. But
I
I mean,
don't
I
know.
could see it being that way because there's so many dictates of television that just kind of go against the grain of good storytelling. And just, you know, there's too many other masters that have to be served. He says, anyway, I guess we can see the traces of Frost here. We get our biggest lore info dump ever when Wyndham explains the Black and White Lodges to poor young Rusty. And we also get more of a sense of Annie's backstory, too. I'm trying to think of some other stuff, like good character moments, but honestly, the non-Cooper Wyndham Annie parts of 25 and 26 tend to blur together in my mind. Anyway, you can really see the writers working towards the season finale in a way that wasn't evident even a few episodes back. What do you guys think of the silhouetted robed figures? Obviously, they don't hold a candle to Bob or the Little Man or whatever, but I enjoy their presence and the feel that Twin Peaks is very much moving back towards engagement with the supernatural forces of the woods after straying into the meandering soap plots for so long. I think that's actually exactly what it is, what you just said, Joel. It's a signpost to saying, okay, we're changing route right here, yeah. And we're going back towards this element of the show and getting away from, you know, Invitation to Love.
Well, I think they've started changing towards that direction, you know, with the Log Lady and Major Briggs showing up to the sheriff's department. Like, they've kind of started steering us this way. And it just shows that we're getting closer at this point. But
yeah.
I think. I don't think it's just now steering that way.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. It's not just now doing it. It has been building up for a little while. But I think the robed figure is kind of like really pushing it, though. You know, saying it's going to go even more in that direction. So there's going to be less of the crap you don't want and more of the good stuff.
Yes.
Hopefully. Well, that's all Joel's got. Mom, thanks for writing.
Thank you, Joel. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah, you guys, like, I sound like a freaking broken record, I know, but you guys' letters are awesome, and you make it worth doing this podcast, especially at this point in season two. And we're about to get to the good part, so.
Yes, yeah, so that's going to be fun, and also, don't forget, we will cover Fire Walk with Me, so just to give you guys time to, you know, if you want to write in for that, because I know that's a bit more hefty material, and I don't know if you want to do a rewatch of that before.
Yeah, just if anybody wants to write in, I'm not even sure how we're going to handle Fire Walk with Me. Are we going to do it as one podcast, or are we going to break it up, or?
I don't know. I was thinking we should discuss how we're going to do a recap for that. And if you guys have any preference, you know, let us know. But other than that, we'll take that into consideration. And
yeah, yeah. If you guys have any ideas. Yeah, do send it our way to let us know. I mean, obviously we'll do, you know, what we feel is going to be the most effective, but it's going to be a monster to take on. So I'm kind of like, I'm anticipating it and excited about it. But at the same time, there's a little bit of trepidation because I'm kind of like, Jesus Christ, this thing is a like 2 hour long plus movie, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And the last time we watched it, for those of you who don't have the complete, Blu-ray box set, it has, like,
I imagine all of these guys have it.
Yeah, you probably all do. But look at the deleted scenes and then check your watch after you've watched them. It's as long as most movies these days,
yeah,
when you watch them all in a row. And not all of them are really integral, but I would like to touch upon, you know, the fight scene and
we'll do,
you know,
that.
Everything else.
The Norma and Ed scene.
The Norma and Ed scene is really good. That should have been left in the goddamn movie.
Yeah.
But anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves. But I just wanted to say thank you, Joel. Thank you, Daniel. Thank you, Tyler. Thank you, John.
Yes, thank you, guys. Cheers. And we will talk to you next week. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.